And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, www.freakradio.org on Thursday, December 31st, New Year's Eve, 2015. I'd like to suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy so that you can take notes. Web pages, email addresses, times, dates, locations, all of those might be useful to you to take action. Let's start off with the news. Coho salmon benefit from a dam removal on San Mateo County Coastal Creek in this story written by Lisa M. Krieger of the San Jose Mercury News. A 77-year-old concrete dam is now gone from San Mateo's Pescadero Creek, opening a route for rare coho salmon to once again return to their ancestral habitat. The dam created a popular swimming hole at Memorial Park in the Redwood Forest of the Santa Cruz Mountains, where kids floated on air mattresses in the chilly waters and searched for crayfish. But it prevented fish from making their swim from the Pacific Ocean to freshwater pools upstream to spawn. The coho was listed as endangered in 2005 and is now on the brink of extinction. The dam was demolished in October by a team led by the San Mateo County Resource Conservation District and San Mateo County Parks Department, and December rains have restricted natural contours, opening up 62 miles of creek habitat for the fish. We're trying to give them a fighting chance where they come to spawn, said Kelly Nelson, Executive Director of San Mateo County Resource Conservation District based in Half Moon Bay. We're doing everything in our power to make sure they have the right habitat to feed, grow fat, and lay eggs before going back out to sea. The dam was built in 1938 to provide a swimming hole near the confluence of Peterson and McCormick Creeks, part of the Works Progress administration of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal to combat unemployment in the Great Depression. But it created an insurmountable barrier for fish in the coastal creek. The dam wall was too high for fish to jump when traveling upstream, and its narrow chute forced a fierce flow of water too strong for the fish to overcome, and it prevented the downstream flow of gravel essential for fish to lay eggs. An additional problem, also now fixed as part of this restoration project, was created by a 1930s-era road crossing designed to provide vehicle access to the park's Sequoia Flat Family Camp. These are great projects which benefit fish, the result of many years of planning layers of initiatives, said Marlene Finley, director of San Mateo Parks Department. Once Pescadero Creek, whose name is Spanish for fish merchant, teemed with coho salmon as well as steelhead trout. While steelhead are still found in Pescadero Creek, coho were believed to have vanished from its waters. Coho, also known as silver salmon, are born in freshwater streams such as Pescadero Creek, where they live for a year before swimming to the ocean. Then they return to lay eggs and fertilize them. Last winter, to great excitement, biologists reported spotting three coho salmon that had recently spawned, including a 26-inch female. These adult fish are believed to have originated in Santa Cruz County's Kingfisher Flat Hatchery on Big Creek, a project of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and State Fisheries, but no fry salmon were detected. This is the fifth barrier to be removed by the San Mateo County Resource Conservation District since 2007. The project received $280,000 in funding from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, with additional funding and effort from the Conservation District and the San Mateo County Parks and Recreation Foundation. Of previous projects, the most formidable was the 2013 removal of a century-old 40-foot-wide concrete barrier from a section of the creek in El Palo Alto Park, on the Palo Alto-Menlo Park border, restoring the stream bed to a more natural course as winter rains deposit necessary gravel and cause the newly restored creek to swell. Biologists will watch closely for salmon to return. This is the time of year we might start to see fish migrate up creek, said Nelson. I'm hoping. And the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. They are declaring victory. Wild buffalo gain Horse Butte all year round. Recently, Montana Governor Steve Bullock issued his final decision on year-round habitat for wild bison in Montana, and the Buffalo Field Campaign is very pleased to announce that after more than 18 years of fighting for wild buffalo to freely roam Horse Butte, we have finally achieved this significant victory. As many of you know, gaining buffalo year-round access to Horse Butte is part of what we have been pressing for since the beginning of our campaign, and we are celebrating this achievement as the victory that it is. Indeed, it may be the biggest victory we have had. It took nearly 2 decades of hard work in the field, in the courts, and in the policy arena to accomplish this, and it demonstrates how perseverance pays off and how we must never give up. This victory is a result of endless pressure being endlessly applied by the Buffalo Field Campaign, by you, our dedicated supporters, and by the incredible and active residents of Horse Butte, and by the buffalo themselves, who consistently demonstrate resistance, persistence, and endurance. Another boon granted the buffalo is that bull bison, but only bulls, will be given year-round habitat in the Gardner Basin. Please celebrate this victory with us, as it has been hard-earned by each of you. Thank you, everyone who has been with us for the buffalo, making our work possible. As we bask in this triumph, we cannot let down our guard. We must strengthen our resolve to continue fighting for wild buffalo and their right to roam the lands that are their birthright. We have many difficult battles yet to win. A closer look at Governor Bullock's decision shows that the buffalo are still in grave danger from livestock industry interests and the government agencies that serve them. Even the decision to grant buffalo year-round habitat on Horse Butte has its devilish details, mainly in the form of a population cap. During fall and winter, approximately 450 buffalo will be allowed to live there. In the spring, that number rises to 600, which is terrific timing, since that's when the large herds come to Horse Butte for calving season. But by July, the government will still allow only 250 buffalo to remain. From reviewing the governor's decision, it appears that should there be more than 250 buffalo on Horse Butte by summer, hazing would not begin until then, which is about 6 weeks later than hazing has been taking place in recent years. While our ultimate goal is to put an end to all hazing, this means that wild buffalo will finally have an opportunity to make their own choices when and whether to migrate into Yellowstone for the summer months. It will be an awesome gift to learn when they will do directly from the buffalo themselves. A deeper look into the governor's decision with more questions than it raises. Hazing, hunting, and capture for slaughter remain tools that the livestock-backed government agencies will employ, with goals of keeping this highly vulnerable and indeed endangered population at artificially low numbers. Additionally, wild buffalo will not be granted any tolerance along the south side of the Madison River, which is favored habitat, mostly public lands that the matriarch-led family groups very much enjoy and require during the months surrounding calving season. Also in the Gardner Basin, matriarch-led family groups will not have full access like their adult male counterparts, but will be given tolerance only during hunting season and will be hazed into Yellowstone by mid-spring. Again, we have a long way to go for buffalo. We need you to join with us in strengthening your resolve and renewing your commitment to do whatever it takes to defend our beloved wild buffalo until they roam free across all the lands that have been their home since buffalo time began. For more information, contact the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Once again, that address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. You could call them at 406-646-0070, repeating 406-646-0070, or go to their webpage where you can find all of this and plenty more information, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a landslide victory for Ogoni farmers as a court rules against Shell Oil in this story from Intercontinental Cry. In a potentially precedent-setting ruling, a Dutch court said Friday that Royal Dutch Shell may be held liable for oil spills at its subsidiaries in Nigeria, a win for farmers and environmentalists attempting to hold the oil giant accountable for spills, leaks, and widespread pollution. The ruling by the Court of Appeals in The Hague, which overturned a 2013 decision in favor of Shell, allows four Ogoni farmers from the Niger Delta to jointly sue the Fossil Fuels Corporation in the Netherlands for causing extensive oil spills in Nigeria. The scars of these disasters are still visible in the fields and fishing ponds of three Nigerian villages. In one village, drinking water has been rendered non-potable, while in another, an entire mangrove forest has been destroyed. Elio Afghani, one of the Ogoni farmers who, along with Friends of the Earth Netherlands, brought the case against Shell, said the ruling offers hope that Shell will finally begin to restore the soil around my village so that I once again will be able to take up farming and fishing on my own land. Beyond that, the court's decision is a landslide victory for environmentalists and those four brave Nigerian farmers who, for more than 7 years, have had the courage to take on one of the most powerful companies in the world, said Gert Rietsema, campaigner at Friends of the Earth Netherlands. This ruling is a ray of hope for other victims of environmental degradation, human rights violations, and other misconduct by large corporations. Indeed, as Amnesty International researcher Mark Dummett said in advance of the ruling, this case is especially important as it could pave the way for further cases from other communities devastated by Shell's negligence. There have been thousands of spills from Shell's pipeline since the company started pumping oil in the Niger Delta in 1958, Dummett said, with devastating consequences for people living there. Decrying the incredible levels of pollution caused by the activities of Shell and its subsidiaries, environmentalists Vinata Shiva and Nimomo Basse said at a media briefing in July that weekends in Ogoni land are marked by carnivals of funerals of people in their 20s and 30s. Citing a 2011 United Nations Environmental Program assessment, they noted that in over 40 locations tested in Ogoni land, the soil is polluted by hydrocarbons up to a depth of 5 meters, about 15 feet, and that all local water bodies in the region are polluted. The UN report, they said, also found that in some places the water was polluted with benzene, a known carcinogen, at levels 900% above World Health Organization standards. With a life expectancy standing at about 41 years, the cleanup of Ogoni land is projected to require a cumulative 30 years to clean up both the land and the water, they said. In another historic victory for the plaintiffs, the Hague Court said, on Friday, it also ordered Shell to give the farmers and environmental activists supporting their case access to internal documents that the court said could shed more light on the case. Chana Samkalden, counsel for the farmers and Friends of the Earth, said it was the first time in legal history that access to internal company documents was obtained in the court. This finally shows the case to be considered on its merits. The court will continue to hear the case against Shell in March of 2016. You can find out about this case and more at www.intercontinentalcry.org. That's intercontinentalcry.org. And from Australia, Direct Action has stopped illegal logging in St. Patrick's River Forest from story written in Geico's Facebooks and from Planet Funder, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Victory. After our direct action to stop illegal logging and then swift work from Environmental East Gippsland and their lawyers, Vic Forest has agreed to stop logging and get out of the forest. A fantastic effort by all, especially the brave crew on the ground who stopped the destruction for the day. We've had word from camp that tree sitter has been removed, but has been arrested, but is safe. Logging has stopped and will not recommence. The action halted habitat destruction, and the vast remainder of the forest remains intact. Nice work, crew. Vic Forest denied any wrongdoing, which we disagree with, but they say they will not log the forest to assist the state government's forestry industry task force. The task force has begun a process to consider rescheduling logging away from contentious areas while discussions take place about the future of the industry and conservation of Victoria's flora and fauna. We'll be keeping a close eye on fixed forest operations, as always. Several other high conservation areas that have not been surveyed for threatened species are scheduled for imminent logging. On December 15th, conservationists from Goonerah Environmental Center took direct action to stop an illegal Vic Forest logging operations in the St. Patrick's Forest and Far East Gippslands. Logging was occurring in threatened species habitat without a legally required pre-logging survey for protected wildlife. Vic Forest is required by law to identify and protect threatened species habitat. Illegal logging of rainforest buffers had also occurred in breach of the logging code of practice. Remarkably, after just one day of action and a letter from lawyers representing Environment East Gippslands, Vic's Forest agreed to stop logging in the forest and logging contractors left. It was an amazing result and successfully prevented the destruction of large areas of high conservation value forest home to threatened species. Most of the forest remains intact and safe from Vic Forest's lawless logging regime. Of the 20 brave people who physically stopped the logging for the day and helped achieve this fantastic result, 8 of them have been issued $500 fines. They will need your help to pay them off quickly so that they can continue to act, get back on the front lines, and stand up for our environment. Several areas of threatened species habitat are scheduled for logging without having legally required wildlife surveys completed. These areas may also be logged in breach of the law, and we need help to keep a close eye on operations. The protesters risked a lot to take these actions, but it was so worth it. Illegal logging has stopped, and the forests of St. Patrick's River area and the wildlife they house remain safe for now. Historic Canadian Fur Trade Fort gets a new lease on life as Site C Dam protest camp in this story by Johnny Wakefield for Alaskan Hawaii Highway News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A fort where explorers Alexander McKenzie and David Thompson took refuge is shaping up to be another flashpoint in the fight over Site C Dam. Opponents of the project have set up a camp at the site of the Rocky Mountain Fort, a provisioning post and the earliest European settlement in mainland British Columbia. While British Columbia Hydro has said it will remove any significant artifacts from the fort, the site itself is set to disappear beneath the dam's 83-kilometer reservoir. Rocky Mountain Fort was lost to history until the 1970s, according to Arthur Hadland, who, as a regional director, sought to have the site recognized for its historic significance. "I tried the province, but it was a waste of time," he said. "They would not touch it. They just blew me off." The fort lies upstream from the mouth of the Moberly River on the south bank of the Peace. The outline of the fort's palisade wall is still visible. The site was established sometime after Alexander McKenzie's 1793 quest for a route to the Pacific Ocean, according to a 1990 article by archaeologists David Burley and Scott Hamilton in the journal BC Studies. It was abandoned in 1804 for Fort St. John, then located at the mouth of the Beaton River. McKenzie noted an abundance of animals in the region, which caught the attention of fur trappers with the Northwest Company. The company had expanded its trapping operations into what is now northern Alberta and needed meat to provision its crews. Early archaeologists discovered tens of thousands of splintered animal bones on the Rocky Mountain Forest site, suggesting it was used for grease rendering. Local First Nations hunters supplied much of the game, making Rocky Mountain Forts one of the first sites of sustained contact between European explorers and indigenous people in the Peace. One such hunter, working freelance, brought in a total of 14,848 pounds of fresh meat to the fort, according to the journal of a Northwest Company officer. "It's the whole significance of that site being so symbolic for whites and First Nations," said dam opponent Ken Boone, of a decision to start a protest camp there alongside Treaty 8 members. "The fact is about the fort, until 1976, when Dr. Newt Fladmark, an archaeologist with Simon Fraser University, rediscovered it after reading a description of the site in David Thompson's journal. Fladmark discovered trade beads, lead balls, shot, lead sprue, and small fragments of brass sheet metal littered about the site, as well as the remains of 3 stone chimneys, a steel button, a knife blade, and a bowl of a Micmac-style pipe. This site is remarkably well-preserved and completely unaffected so far by modern disturbances," Fladmark wrote in 1985. The 2014 report of the Site C Joint Review Panel noted Rocky Mountain Fort would be inundated should the dam be built, despite BC Hydro's plan to mitigate the loss through relocation, systematic data recovery, capping, monitoring, and compensation in kind, such as replication. While sections of the south bank downstream of the Moberly River have been logged, the site of the fort remains untouched. However, the area is slated for clearing, which will take place in the first 3 months of 2016. At some point, boat traffic will be restricted, making site access an issue, Bones said. Site C spokesperson Dave Conway said BC Hydro is aware of the encampment, but noted it is not presently interfering with our on-site construction activities, according to an email. As of recently, it was not known how many people were living at the camp. Boone said it remains to be seen whether there will be a confrontation over the site. I guess we'll see, he said. BC Hydro keeps saying they're going to put construction buoys in, and I see that initially boats will be able to pass through that area, so I guess we'll see what they decree. And a lawsuit has challenged the failure to protect coastal martens in this story written by the Environmental Protection Information Center. Two conservation groups have sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for failing to protect the coastal martin under the Endangered Species Act. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Environmental Protection Information Center first petitioned for protection of the coast martin, sometimes known as the Humboldt martin, in 2010. Represented by Earth Justice, the groups are now challenging the service's April 2015 decision not to award federal protection to the martin. The bushy-tailed carnivores were once common, but now fewer than 100 of them survive in California, while an unknown but very small number are still found in Oregon. A slender mustelid related to minks and otters, the coastal martin survives only in three isolated populations of old-growth forest and dense coastal shrub in northern California and southern and central Oregon. The science clearly shows the coastal martin deserves protection under the Endangered Species Act, but the agency ignored its own scientists in making the political decision to betray the martin, said Tara Curry, senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity and lead author of the petition to protect the martin. The martin faces a barrage of threats, including logging fire, climate change, trapping in Oregon, vehicle strikes, rodenticide poisoning, and small population size. In denying the martin protection, the service ignored the best available science, including its own scientific report. In the past year, the agency has come under increasing criticism for overruling its own scientists and too often bowing to political pressure. We're dealing with an animal that is already extinct throughout more than 83% of its historic range. It's like discovering that the ivory-billed woodpecker still exists, yet refusing to protect it, said Greg Glory, an attorney for Earth Justice representing the groups. If they're going to survive and recover, coastal martins desperately need the protection of the Endangered Species Act. The service's decision not to protect the coastal martin is scientifically and morally unjustifiable, said Rob DiPerna, Environmental Protection Information Center's California Forest and Wildlife Advocate. The martin is a special part of the natural heritage of the Northwest and deserves full protection. The coastal martin's historic range extended from Sonoma County in coastal California north through the coastal mountains of Oregon in Oregon. The martin now lives only in a small area within Siskiyou and Suislaw National Forests. Coastal martins are believed extinct in California, with 95% of their old-growth forest habitat lost and a history of excessive trapping until they were rediscovered on the Six Rivers National Forest in 1996. In 2009, the first California martin to be photographed in recent times was detected at Prairie Creek Redwood State Park by remote sensing cameras. The extremely secretive animals are known for their slinky walking motion and expert hunting skills. Typically about 2 feet long with large triangular ears and a long tail, they eat smaller mammals, berries, and birds, and are preyed upon by larger mammals and raptors. You can get more information at www.wildcalifornia.org. And in other news, rewilding the Northwest, Pacific fishers are reintroduced in Washington state in this story by Ben Goldfarb of High Country News, as found in the Earth First Newswire. These are thrilling times to be a wildlife aficionado in the Pacific Northwest, a region whose ecosystems grow richer with each passing day. Wolverines have been trickling into northern Washington for years. Biologists are still dumping bull trout into Oregon's Clackamas River. Wolves are steadily gaining ground in both states. The grizzly bear, a candidate for reintroduction in the North Cascade, looms on the rugged horizon. Meanwhile, a less heralded creature is also experiencing a quiet revival. The Pacific fisher, a cat-sized mammal akin to weasels, martens, and otters, unlike its cousin the wolverine, fishers haven't reinfiltrated Washington on their own. Rather, they've had help from Homo sapiens, the very species that once extirpated them. On December 3rd, the fisher's recovery took an enormous bound forward. Before a crowd of 50 onlookers, the state released 7 fishers into Gifford Pinchot National Forest, the first time the creature has been seen in the Southern Cascades in more than 70 years. Fishers are capable of impressive arboreal acrobatics. They den in tree cavities and can rotate their hind paws 180 degrees to descend from their roost head first. But they're most renowned for their predatory abilities. Woe betide the porcupine that crosses a fisher's path. The fierce carnivore dances circles around its quilled quarry, weakening it with blows to the head before finally flipping it over, and as Brian Doyle, a writer so appreciative of mustelids that he named a town after one, puts it, scooping out the meat as if the prickle pig were merely a huge startled breakfast melon. Despite those inestimable skills, fishers historically proved no match for the rapacious hunter of all. Prized by trappers for its lush fur, the fisher was completely wiped out in the Evergreen State in the mid-1900s. In the West, they survived only in southwest Oregon and northern California, where they're now imperiled by rat poison spread by illegal marijuana growers. In the northeastern United States, the picture is considerably sunnier, as fishers are resettling habitat from Appalachia up into the Bronx. And you can find out this story and other information at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. That's earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is normally produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this show, please tune in at 3 o'clock Friday afternoon right here to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM or streaming live at www.freakradio.org. You can also go to Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. 90.3 FM KRFP rebroadcasts the Earth First Update at 1:15 p.m. on Wednesdays after Democracy Now! And you can always go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Updates. Once again, that website, radioforall.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.